Hello, Joe. You're back. How you doing?
I'm great, Tim. How are you?
Very good. Well, tonight we want to discuss. There was an article actually that was referred to me. I think it was based on one of our previous discussions. A listener provided a link to this article regarding the business plot, and the actual title of it. Let me just scroll down here because I have notes above it. A lot of notes above it. Let's see. Yeah, The Bogus Business Plot, Part 1, What Isn't a Racket? And then the subtitles with commentary on the Great Depression, the New Deal, the Roosevelt, Warburg, Morgan, Spencer families, and a whole lot more by Josh G. He had posted this at Miles Mathis' website, and I finally got a chance to read it and was impressed with it. So I decided maybe it would be a good topic for us to talk about. And the business plot. What's your take on this business plot that so many alternative researchers sort of base their understanding and their other research on?
Well, I think it was a distraction, a misdirection. I think that the article that you reference is excellent. I mean, I think that I don't know Josh. I've never spoken with him, but I think he's a very good researcher. He sure opened my eyes to a lot of things that I didn't know. But I will say that I had thought that the business plot was basically a limited hangout, not because of Butler's part of it, but because I knew that Roosevelt was someone who was creating false narratives. Right? You and I have talked about his relationship with the attorney Wechsler. And how they, created these laws that permitted sexual degeneracy to be impossible for local communities to resist, right? And so, you have Roosevelt's claim to be for the common person, but then when I looked into him, based on the stuff we did, about the Kinzer Report and how Wechsler and Roosevelt were basically promoting sexual degeneracy, the fact that Roosevelt, through his family and through his whole life, had been wired into the banking class, just made me, without any further research, certain that it was just something that was done to distract people, because Roosevelt was not doing anything. None of his programs were going to control or reduce the wealth of the banking class or the Federal Reserve. I mean, Roosevelt was the Federal Reserve. His family was on the board of directors, and all of the Federal Reserve members supported him, and were giving money before, for his presidential race. So when I went, without doing a lot of research, I just always thought that the business plot was just a distraction. And just to be clear, so people can understand what we're talking about, is that the idea was that if you could create a rumor that the bankers of J.P. Morgan and the Warburgs, et cetera, were trying to organize a coup because they were so upset by what Roosevelt was doing. Right, that this would basically give Roosevelt some cred with the common person, because they would go, oh, gee, these hated bankers are trying to get rid of our beloved FDR. So that was that was what it was. It was a distraction. It was a false narrative just to confuse people. But then the researcher who posted his article on Miles's website, Josh, goes a lot further, doesn't he, Tim?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that he does. They're not digressions, because they're I think that it's related, because it all gets into the oligarchy and how the financial system is manipulated and how that financial leverage is used to sort of take control of the economy of industries, whether it's labor unions or the medical industrial complex, and how that's further used to sort of harvest or extract wealth indirectly through chronic illnesses and drugs, poisonous drugs, and of course the manipulation of the banking system with the interest rates, and how that can, you know, direct capital flows to certain favored corporations, which leads to concentration, which leads to, you know, well, the New World Order. So yeah, but the business plot, you know, let's go to All Things Wikipedia, of course, for basic history. The business plot, also known as the White House coup, was an alleged political conspiracy in 1933 in the United States. Retired Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler claimed the wealthy businessmen were plotting to create a fascist veterans organization with Butler as his leader and use it as a sort of a coup d'etat to overthrow FDR. In 1934, Butler testified before the U.S. House of Representatives Special Committee on Un-American Activities, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee. No one was ever prosecuted for it. The committee itself published a report, said there was likely a plot, but no action was taken. At the time, the news media dismissed the plot as a gigantic hoax. That was the New York Times. Time magazine covered it, which Josh G. tends to say leads you to believe that it simply it was a hoax, because real plots don't get covered in the New York Times. I agree with his logic, yeah. Considering who owns the New York Times, and who owns Time Magazine, and who owned FDR, and also this, he points out in the article that Smedley Butler himself had come across as a critic of these guys. You know, he gave a speech. He was for 33 years. He was a muscle man for big business and Wall Street and these things, bill collector, that sort of thing, and. You know, he wrote the book War is a Racket, which is an excellent book. Blames, you know, corporate greed and Wall Street for America's entry into the First World War, and also war in general is a they're bankers' wars. They're made to socialize cost and privatize profit, socialize risks rather, therefore to guarantee private profits. But if that were true, if he were this sort of this trenchant critic of, you know, of the ruling class, why would they pick him as the sort of the front man for this coup? It's rather strange. So
right. And also, I just wanted to mention that Josh goes into some really important tangents and digressions. As his research goes through the paper, he comes across one little, you know, nest of malfeasance that is somewhat related to the business plot, but then he tries to put sunlight on it. And I want to compliment him on his methodology. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is exactly how people should be processing through history as we actually go back now and recreate the real history. And believe me, it's an all hands work party. Mm-hmm. I am just delighted that, you know, to be part of with you and with Josh and Miles and so many people that are trying to actually present to the public the real history. We're trying to see what really happened to us. And, you know, and just to add to Josh's research, I mean, he gets into sugar, and he shows that yes. Sugar is, you know, obviously it's a toxin, and he shows the relationship between, you know, the business plot individuals and how often they end up as basically controlling what he calls Big Sugar. Mm-hmm. And he talks about Butler's defense of Big Sugar. And then he goes into the pain that it causes. And then he digresses. And he goes, you know, he talks about this fact in the New York Times that opioids killed 33,000 people. And then he just goes on and he talks about how often the number 33 appears. Yes. You know, 33,000 gun deaths, 33 Haitian children that Laura Silsby supposedly trafficked for the Clintons, the 33 refugees who drowned off the Turkish coast a few months ago. And they, you know, anyway, he just goes on and on.
And Smedley Butler, 33 years.
Well, that was what I was going to say.
Oh, sorry.
He missed that one,
yeah.
Which I think is important because, you see, and also I think he didn't explain what it is. I mean, 33 is just an identifying marker for the Freemasons. I mean, 33 is obviously, you know, supposedly the high level. And when you use that number, you're just giving a cue to the fellow brother Masons that this story is Masonic, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think basically that you would know that it's not real, that this is just propaganda. And so Smedley starts off his screed against war and the oligarchs by, you know, with the statement, you know, I've been in the army 33 years. For 33 years, I was running a racket. And this is just a little way to identify that for the high-level Masons that the rest of the story is just a, you know, it's a propaganda piece that is fitting into the Masonic goal of genocide of the Europeans and world domination. Mm-hmm. And so that's why all of, you know, whenever you see this number, you know, pay attention because, you know, quite often it's actually just a little, you know, tip that you're dealing with a Masonic project. But I'm really glad that he shows that, you know, when you start to uncover something like the business plot, right, and you show, wait a second, this is bogus, it's not real. We'll go into that in a little bit as to why, you know, the research that shows that it's just completely fake, that it's a distraction. When you look at the supporting history of the individuals involved, then you have new areas of research that pop up. And so what he branches off into is to sugar, because so many of these guys are controlling what he calls big sugar. Mm-hmm. And then into the physical agony that so many people are in as a result of ingestion of sugar, an addiction to sugar. And then they have pain, and for which they're given opioids, which they then become addicted to.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's just but what I wanted to say was that just as my way of understanding, like, the methodology of the new history, the real history, is that we should always be willing to segue when we uncover something like this. And we should always bear in mind that, you know, that health, that mental health, that you know, that these things are all completely related. Mm-hmm. That there is no distinction between the you know, the false narrative and the distraction. There's no distinction in terms of the overall plot that you're dealing with between the distraction and trying to give the impression that FDR was hated by bankers, right? The big bankers. And then the way that sugar is used against the population, it's just another attack by the same group for the same purpose. So whenever you do come across this, I'm talking, you know, to the researchers and to the general public, when you come into an area like, you know, the business plot, it's wonderful that these segues are made because they're just filling in the details so that people can see that the entire history and culture has been, you know, designed as a weapon against them, and that's why then when you look at FDR and then move one, you know, step over and you see that he was an audience member and a supporter of Edward Bernays's degenerate play Damaged Goods, and then you see Roosevelt basically giving Wechsler the green light to get rid of all of the powers of the small sovereignties, the cities, the counties, the states, to be able to resist degeneracy with local laws, then it's, you see what I mean? And then it's fleshing it out. It's creating an easier to understand whole, and all of these elements support one another so that people, as we go through and understand the new history, it just makes a lot more sense. It's a lot more solid.
No, I just think it's the impersonal forces of history. We can't blame anybody. It's just
yeah, you're right. Just unfolds, buddy. It just unfolds.
History unfolding. Come on, you can't stop it.
Yeah, come on. It's like Noam Chomsky, you know.
Yeah.
And the building just fell down. What are you worried about?
Yeah. Yeah. Kennedy might have missed. Who cares who shot Kennedy? It doesn't matter.
Right.
Or why.
You just relax. And that's why they have the new meme is relax, you know, it's just to stay calm.
Yes,
you know,
keep calm,
carry on. You know, yeah.
The now he writes, well, I'm going to do him justice, I'll read his paragraph about the business plot. The argument I put forward here is very simple. The plausibility of the business plot rests on the assumption that Roosevelt's policies, especially in 1933 and 1934, went against the interest of bankers, industrialists, and Wall Street financiers, or at the very least, very powerful subset of them, including the Morgans, DuPonts, who were implicated. Implied is that his policies were so beyond the pale that he was nearly deposed or turned into a puppet of a fascist government controlled by the likes of J.P. Morgan Jr. Well, that already occurred. Anyway, on top of that, we also need to believe that Smedley Butler was the kind of guy who would stand up to the powerful bankers and rat them out due to his patriotism, integrity, and dedication to democracy. At the same time, we need to believe he's the kind of guy the bankers would have approached to lead the coup, even though by then he was already going around giving speeches condemning war profiteers and exclaiming that war is a racket. You can see the story is already starting to fall apart under its own internal contradictions before I've even started to show that none of the assumptions are true. Roosevelt's policies were practically dictated by wealthy bankers, Wall Street financiers, big business, and Smedley Butler was a big, fat, phony, actually short and skinny one, but you get my point. Now, this he doesn't really address in the article. I mean, he's leaving that to the sequel, whether or not Smedley Butler was witting or unwitting in this hoax. But nevertheless, it just doesn't seem to be genuine. It was manufactured. So I thought that was a good summation of his argument. And in the article, he draws these connections, these professional business and also familial connections, which makes it ridiculous even to entertain the idea that Roosevelt was some sort of traitor to his class and these businessmen who, if you look at the New Deal itself, he staffed it with all these, you know, like Bernard Baruch, Burl, these guys who had all connections to J.P. Morgan. And also, we're supposed to believe that J.P. Morgan, the House of Morgan, was conspiring against Roosevelt. I mean, yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
It's ludicrous. Yeah. The Baruch and Warburg were Roosevelt's big financial supporters. They were the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. And the idea that Roosevelt was somehow a threat to them is just, I mean, it's hard even to understand how it could be swallowed when it's supported by, you know, the New York Times. You know, this is an example, in my opinion, of how the oligarchs are going to have to kind of switch gears, and how they are. They're creating better memes to control people, because I don't think this kind of crap would actually work today. I think there's too much independent research that would just call BS on this stuff immediately. They would just start pointing out that that Roosevelt is an oligarch, that his family, I mean, if you look into the Delanos, yes, you know, I mean, you've nothing but the Federal Reserve. The idea that the bankers who created him and who sit on all of these boards that he's created to manage the economy, right, mm-hmm, would find something wrong. I mean, he gave them everything. There was nothing left to give, for God's sakes.
He even built the Fed a new building, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, come on. It's just this is not believable. It's not believable. And you see this, okay, so it starts to, you know, so I think the story, just when you lay the facts out, you know, on a table and go, okay, well, this is where Roosevelt's money's coming from. Here are the bankers that are on his boards. These are the powers that he gave him. This is how they benefited from his financial policies. I mean, for example, his maneuver with gold, mm-hmm, benefited the oligarchs. I won't go into it, it's kind of technical, but yeah, they just made a fortune off this guy. And now there's this idea that they're going to have a coup against him. It's completely absurd. So this is basically now an area of research for the new scholar, right, to find the real history. And then you start getting in as to how they constructed the propaganda. You see, this is how you want to go through it. And because what you're going to get when you start to actually break apart these historical stories, these narratives, is you'll get to see where the real power is and how it's always being used to destroy the same groups. And he brought up one fact that is something that I think we should actually do a show about, something that I've been studying for some time, and that is that the Warburgs, who were some of the original money in back of Roosevelt, right? They need a little sunlight put on them because, going all the way back to World War I, and when you had the Treaty of Versailles, on one side you had the American representative, who of all people was Paul Warburg, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you see, the problem I have is that on the other side you have his brother, who was the German representative.
That's right? The tragedy of the First World War, because it set up brother against brother. No.
Yeah. Oh, God. And the idea is that then Versailles ends up with the Germans in a catastrophic situation in terms of debt, which then leads to the collapse of the Deutschmark.
Yeah.
And then, of course, now you have this character Hitler come forward. But when you look at it as coming from the same group that created the false narrative, right, of the banker plot, of the business plot, now Versailles and then onward into Hitler, suddenly you realize that, wait a second, this really should be studied as a part of the same project.
Now, how about this Jewish banking family controlling IG Farben?
Well, that's something people don't know, but you see, I want to get in that segment. I just wanted to go on and say, is that you have to remember that. So as you go forward from the Warburgs on both sides of the table creating the catastrophic Treaty of Versailles, right, mm-hmm. which everyone knows was crazy and just leads to an immediate collapse of the German financial structure, which was designed to do that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now you go forward and you have the Hitler coming from the, of all things, the Thule Society, which is where the Nazis come from. You know, now Aleister Crowley and Helen Blavatsky. So you've got this bizarre, you know, kind of Masonic club spinning off this strange Nazi party. But now, lo and behold, you start getting back into the American banking family. This time it's Brown Harriman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Brown Harriman, if you ever look at the founding members of this thing, because I know, they always talk about the Bush family,
yeah,
right? Well, go back just one step and look at the founding members of Brown Harriman and compare this to Skull and Bones. Tim, it is Skull and Bones. It's not some project that somehow picked up a few members. The whole foundation of the law firm and the investment banking company is Skull and Bones. That's what the darn thing is.
Yeah, it's like OSS or SCIA, yeah.
See, now this group then funds the Nazis, or at least, you know, there's money being moved around that they end up being able to use, right, because mm-hmm. Prescott Bush, another Skull and Bone guy who was working with these guys. So now Hitler, when you look at it in this context, right, you can see that Hitler is the goal of this group. It isn't like, oh my God, history's unfolding. That's the old history, Tim. The new history is, the business plot is a really good example of the way they create fake historical narratives to try to shape culture. And they're always, by shaping culture, they're always reducing population of people they don't like.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have the Warburgs on both sides of the table, then you have Brown Harriman and Skull and Bones funding the Nazi party. And then at the end of the war, you bring in Yoon Cameron, the MK Ultra psychopath, to tell the world how depraved the German people were. You see, suddenly this whole World War II meme doesn't look very realistic, doesn't look very believable, does it?
No, yeah. And with that, the whole modern world that we know, it becomes a, it's a production. It's a stage show.
And Tim, here on our show, I'm going to give a little bonbon, something that will be in the new book I'm writing, but I actually am holding, of all things, a 1,000-ruble note issued in 1917 by the interim government. In other words, what you had was the Tsar collapsed,
mm-hmm.
there was an interim government, and then the Bolsheviks came to power. So during a period of time, this interim government, which was basically just the transition to the Bolsheviks, they issued notes Now, these notes were then issued for a period of time by the Bolsheviks, right? Now, they're very, very important because they contain an incredible historical piece of evidence as to what's going on here. It's a little hard to see because they've kind of hidden it in the note, but it is very visible when you hold it up to light. It's a swastika, 1917. This is the Bolsheviks. Now, not only is it a swastika, but it's a right-angled swastika, yeah. Right? Oh, like the Nazi one. Yeah. Now here's the little bonbon. It's also precisely angled, so that the bottom tip is of the broken cross is like what touches the floor. So that what you have then is the 45-degree angle, right, which is what the damn Nazi flag has, right, with the swastika, mm-hmm. which is now something you can put perfectly inside the Masonic emblem of the square and compass. You see, so that's now this is 1917. I'm holding the damn note. You see, these are available. You can go online and look at this because people have noticed it. They just didn't make any sense to them because they're trying to look in the old history. See, in the new history, you look at this and you go, just like the number 33. This is just the brand representing itself in a little cryptic way of who is in charge here. You see. So this is the guy who ran this interim thing was a guy named Krasinski, right? He handed power over to the Bolsheviks. Mm-hmm. He tried to have, when he died, a Christian burial, right? The church turned him down because he was too involved with Freemasonry.
Oh, the good old days. No.
Yeah, this was the good old days. So, right. So anyway, that's your interim government, yeah. And that's... Okay, so that's the swastika. This is 1917. This is when the two Warburg brothers are on either side of the table, you know, dicing up the Treaty of Versailles. They're going to go back, and they're going to work with their friends, and these are really close friends, at Brown Harriman, right? And money's going to come forward, and then you're going to have this party, the Nazis, suddenly have all kinds of ways of funding itself. And lo and behold, you know, Prescott Bush is going to, oversee this whole thing. And now here's the final thing, which is what I wanted to laugh. I thought it'd be long-winded, but, okay, I.G. Farben. Mm-hmm. Okay, I.G. Farben, which is going to make, you know, Zyklon B. Oh, dear, you know, this is a terrible company. Oh, who's running I.G. Farben? Max Warburg. It's Paul's brother. He is he's the head of the board of directors. He is I.G. Farben. Now, when I.G. Farben was built, was you know, people were wondering, well, what happened? Why didn't we bomb I.G. Farben? We bombed everything else. Well, gee, Tim. It was like the one industrial thing that wasn't bombed by the Allies in World War II. The I.G. Farben businesses weren't bombed, and they were avoided. Now, at the end of the war, all of the directors of I.G. Farben were accused of war crimes, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They were all accused, every one of them, right? There were charges brought. One guy. Uh-oh. Who was that? Well, it's good old Daddy Warbucks, Max Warburg. He wasn't charged for some reason, right? So, I mean, I hate to say this, but this stinks. This is a cesspool. Mm-hmm. This is the so-called, you know, history that's given to people. It makes no sense whatsoever. It stinks. And I think it's time we put some sunlight on us because we are still so controlled and being... damaged by a fake history in terms of what was World War II, who the characters were, what went on. It's all fake, brother. This is no more real than the business plot by the bankers to get rid of the banking shill FDR.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But yeah, it's amazing. You look at something like I.G. Farben, where I.G. Farben was supposedly involved, and of course, It had all types of stock swaps and shared agreements, and I think they shared patents with Standard Oil.
Yeah.
You know, and...
You know? Yeah, which the Roosevelt family's on the board of directors. I mean, it's just yeah. it's the whole thing is just it's look and okay now Josh then goes one of the, another thing he does so a couple things I really like. One is he ties it into health. He shows that yes. that this group is damaging the physical health and making stupidity and pain. Right, he's you're eating sugar, type 2 diabetes. They're there with the opioids for the chronic pain. You know, they're trying to dance.
They're framing fat as the cause for cardiovascular disease.
Exactly. The whole heart attack thing is just being fed to the people with you know, just so that to continue to lead them down the path to ill health, because they're trying to create a brave new world where they have intellectual stratification. You're too in pain. You're too stupid. Your brain doesn't develop normally. You're just going to be a perfect slave, right, mm-hmm. until they wipe you out. So when Josh segues into that, it's really great. This is something that people should always remember to do. Really want to, you know, congratulate him on that. And then the same thing when he gets into, you know, he says you scratch the surface of these the people who are on Roosevelt's committees, Warburg, Baruch, right?
His brain trust, yeah.
You know, these guys are part of this Masonic cesspool that is creating the catastrophe in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. Which is then going to be blamed on the German people. Ewan Cameron, the MK Ultra psychopath, will then come forward and at the fake Nuremberg trial, which is run by Edward Bernays' nephew, for God's sakes. I mean, the whole thing is just a propaganda device. And then Ewan Cameron is going to come forward and say, "Oh, look, these dark Germans, we got to control them psychologically with, you know, I mean, with like a chemical comas and electroshock, like I do my patients back in my clinic, you know."
Yep.
So there it is, folks. I mean, this should be, you know, there's enough details here, I think, for a normal person, you know, can work through it and just say, you know, man, we have really been fed a bill of goods, and it's one that damages us. It makes us, you know, physically weak with the sugar, with the poisons, and intellectually weak because, you know, the history of the world wars or so, we don't know what really happened. So anyway, there it is. And Josh is to be congratulated. He did a good job, you know, bringing a lot of this stuff out.
Yeah, he also gets into some of not just the wars, but the economic crises that bring on the wars are also created. Of course, they do this through these controlling mechanisms like the Federal Reserve. You've always had bank panics, and bank system has always been kind of fraudulent to begin with because of fractional reserve banking, but it was localized usually. But when you brought in a centralized system, then these people had at their control mechanisms to create a boom and bust cycle, which they, since they have, you know, occulted knowledge, they could be on the right side of that when it comes down, which is apparently they did, because you had enormous wealth concentration, and you didn't have wealth loss. You had wealth concentration in the Great Depression, because the wealth itself was largely imaginary. It was paper. Although you could sustain a nominal loss, if you gained greater concentration of wealth, you came out ahead, you know, because you had the deflationary depression, and which is what they seem to manage. Because as he goes into saying, the whole creation of the Federal Reserve was built on a bank panic spread on by J.P. Morgan in 1907. Knickerbocker Trust Company failure, which was J.P. Morgan, the banking house, J.P. Morgan himself, undermined through a whispering campaign. And that's when that became the pretext, you know, for this Jekyll Island conference, which was held in secret, where the law was actually devised, and it was implemented through the Senate, through Nelson Aldrich, who had married into the Rockefeller family, you know. So, you know, they're all this, you know, planning this financial coup. Sort of finalizing it, because if you go into the late 18th century, they were gaining control of the economy then. But they needed the bank, they needed the Federal Reserve Act under the guise of banking reform, an anti-bankers act, to gain total control of the economy. Then they could create these booms and busts, which I've stated before that it was Charles Lindbergh, the senator, who said that now, you know, booms and busts will be scientifically managed. And yet they were. But there was a part here in his. He makes a point in his article, talks about how sort of the corporate scapegoats and how it allows people to avoid naming names, because he gets into this familial connection, these familial connections, which are very important, cousins marrying cousins and bloodlines, which still matter. But he writes here,
and there are crypto Jews. He's very clear about that. And again, it's another one of his digressions that I think should always be looked at as an area of potential research, because he shows really clearly that a lot of these aristocratic bloodlines seem to be basically originally Jews that converted to Christianity purportedly.
Yes.
And that he does this because the idea is that so now you have a basis, a centrifugal energy as to how these groups can stay together. You know, and he actually he brought out something that I was unaware of. He actually had a quote from FDR because there's always been this concern that the Roosevelts were Jewish. Well, he actually, Josh, has a quote from FDR himself saying, "Yeah, my family, back when we think they were Jews." And so, that really is very, very important. He also has a lot of primary citations about like the Spencers, mm-hmm. another family that twists and turns with the banking, with the East-West trading, and all of these elements of power.
That ties into the Churchills, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And the Churchill family, right. And so then if this is the case, in other words, and Josh makes the, at a certain point, he's very clear about where he can show evidence and where the, the trails just lead to nothing.
And the Warburgs originally, they come from Venice, right?
Yeah, they were a banking family. They were just called the banking family. I mean, I'm not sure what their names were. But when you're talking about the Warburgs, really, are the Loebs or the Schiff? It's really just the Rothschild family.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a group of Jewish families that interbreed, right? You can look at that. That is something you can, basically just parse together very easily. And when you see members from that inbred circle in positions of power and then interacting with other individuals and in a mysterious way, you go, well, what's holding these people together, right? Then Josh does a good job of saying, well, it could be, he says, if you go back to the Spencers and he named, like the Churchills, they could well be basically see themselves as, from a Jewish lineage. And so that's how would be kind of one of the aspects that holds them together as a society and permits them to have secrecy.
Mm-hmm. Now, he addresses that here, talking about how some of this analysis where people analyze, the corporate culture and how that is the root of the problem. Sort of these corporate scapegoats. It allows people to avoid naming names, these elite family names. And he writes, there are many academics during the 20th century who made hay over the growing power and importance of management, of who were eclipsing the power of owners. Sociologists have been referred to as managers as the new class, since they stand behind the bourgeoisie, the proletariat. But just as part of Marx's project was to redirect criticism away from wealthy Jewish bankers and industrialists, and instead focus on criticism on nameless, faceless classes, B&M, that's Burl and Mean, I think was a book they wrote, in their ilk, redirect our criticism onto corporations and upper management, smokescreens and middlemen. You see, one of the advantages of the legal fiction of a corporation, besides the financial and legal protections to shareholders, is that it adds another layer of fog for these same people to hide behind, who might be called a PR shield. The corporations and their executives are like the wizards of Oz with the crypto Jewish in parentheses. Jewish trillionaire families like the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, the Spencers, the Stanleys, the Rockefellers, the Morgans hiding behind a curtain. Of course, it's not easy to dig deeper because the trillionaire families have built an elaborate set of defenses hiding behind corporate managers, hedge fund managers, investment bankers, tax dodgers, hidden bank accounts. They want us to forget that people are still in control, make decisions, not just corporate fictions. So they're flesh and blood people making these decisions who are responsible, as opposed to, casting blame on some, abstraction like a corporation or corporate culture. I thought that was a good point.
It's a very good point. And, see, it clarifies like analysis. So I'll give you a really good example of like this vaccine business, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to do a show on vaccines. I'm not sure when, but eventually we will. And, you know, people talk about, well, there's this profit motive, right? The dollar, that's what's driving all this. Mm-hmm. And that is, in my opinion, a smokescreen that hides the fact that, well, actually it's genetic and intellectual control and genocide that's in back of the vaccines. The idea that they're doing, you know, that they're creating autism and these kinds of rates to make money is preposterous. That's just a distraction, mm-hmm. you see. It's just a distraction. And that's why in the article that we're discussing, Josh does, I think, a good job. You know, he brings out the fact that, you know, that the plot was just to give Roosevelt some credibility with the people on the ground. And you know, it does deflect away, right? When he talks, and he does a good job, he talks about how Smedley, General Smedley Butler, you know, the war is a racket, that this is a limited hangout. You see, this gives the idea that war is done to make money. The bankers are greedy, right? But that's just there. That idea is just there to hide the reality, which is this is there to genocide. Mm-hmm. It's to reduce population. That's what the wars are for. If they want money, they own the Federal Reserve. They'll just print some. Money's nothing to them. It's meaning. It's just a system of power. What you're talking about is population reduction. You see, that's why Butler, in his little screed where he's talking about, oh, they're making all this money. Oh, look, they don't give a damn about money. They control money. The printing press is something they own, right? And during the 08 financial crisis, the European banks got in trouble, so Bernanke gave them $16 trillion in a swap for the euro, $16 trillion. This was without any kind of control.
But he had that, like, stashed under his mattress or something?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, you see, this is the point, is that people worry about profit. I mean, money is just it's just ludicrous. It's just a way to control people. It's mm-hmm. part of the psychological, you know, structure of our belief about reality, our history. You know, you have the Holocaust, the dollar, the business, all these different things that are in our mind, you know, they've been placed there for a purpose. But the point is that Butler is very carefully and very cleverly, he's moving you away from the idea that it might be a secret society that's interested in population reduction to the idea, well, it's just greedy bankers, right? Mm-hmm. That's a whole different area, and it's a very kind of conclusion. Well, all we have to do to fix the thing is just have better banking regulations, right? Right.
Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall.
Yeah, Glass-Steagall, right.
He even addresses that issue, which is pretty good, about Carter
right.
Glass.
I mean, and he also points out how absurd the Glass-Steagall was, but that's a technical thing that, you know, we can get into, but it's like the general point here is that the limited hangout is always designed to deflect the people from realizing the secret society is there and the secret society is interested in genocide. It's not there just for domination. It's not there just to make money. It wants to be on the planet by itself, right? And that's why when you look at the 20th century where they control things, when you look at the Warburgs on both sides of the Versailles Treaty, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go, well, what happens, let's see, to the population of the Europeans after this? Oh, gee, we lose another 100 million. See, these are the kinds of numbers that they're dealing in, the kind of historical energies and forces that are coming out of the secret society. It's basically genociding a population. That's what it does.
Yeah, that's where you have these clashes of huge armies and mass casualties, the bombing, the aerial bombing.
And walking into the automatic weapon fire. Yeah. You know, it's like the World War II trench stuff. I mean, there's just no military purpose at all. It's just that you got the Masons and the Warburg boys on both sides of the aisle, and they're saying, go in there and get and die. It's the whole purpose.
World War One, if you read the history, the standard history, it was war by timetables. It was inevitable. It was just there wasn't anyone there in a decision-making process that had the good judgment or decency just to stop this train wreck from occurring. And again, history unfolding. It's, you know, the alliance system and these things. There was a bigger plan unfolding here, and it was organized. The war was planned out, and it was necessary for these people to have this conflict, to have that loss of life, to have the destruction, because that's how they consolidated power, you know.
Yeah, well, that's how they got rid of the population. Yeah. That's how they set up the modern Europe slave state.
Yeah, and also within this the Freemasonic project, certain countries weren't totally taken over. You could argue that Germany was outside the Anglo, you know, Freemasonic fold, and so was Russia. It wasn't completely in, so it had to be, these two countries had to be destroyed. Or,
you know. I just think that I think when you look at the Nazis, right, and how they set up the Germans as the blonde Aryan race, master yeah. race, right, and then you look at how the German legions were kind of cutouts of the Roman legions. They had the eagle as a standard, mm-hmm. you know. And then remember that the swastika is simply the broken cross of Christianity. I mean, I think that basically this is just a religious pageant that basically, you know, was a settling a score. You know, they were going to get at the Romans, you know, in their descendants and wipe them out. And so that is a, you know, can I prove that? Well, you know, but again, it's as part of the new history. Maybe other researchers can help, you know, kind of flesh this out. It is a critical area of research that, you know, that I would hope that, you know, if people find our discussion of interest, then they would use that as a platform for more, you know, more investigation and more public disclosure.
Yeah. Now, in the piece, he also talks, you know, if the business plot was indeed a hoax, and I think he makes a good case that it was, I mean, there might have been some people actually kind of, you know, people like this guy, what was his name? The bond trader who was kind of supposedly talking to Butler about it, who died in hospital at age 37 in 1935 or something.
Yeah.
You know, who actually spoke before the committee, and, you know, he was wasn't a big guy, so he couldn't have been the ringleader, of course. So you in order to solidify to get the idea that it was true, you're gonna have to have some people acting out, you know, meeting and talking and laying nuggets of evidence to make it seem like it's has some validity. That's apparently that's what occurred. But to say that it was a hoax, you're saying the FDR was indeed a hoax, and so was the New Deal. And he addresses why the New Deal, rather than being this sort of this progressive legislation to protect the common man and to regulate the economy accordingly, to correct for the sort of the blind, greedy capitalist system that had collapsed in 1929. He addresses some, you know, why the New Deal was a racket, which is interesting. You know, the National Industrial Recovery Act, NRA, which was eventually ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. It was led by this Morgan guy, Hugh Johnson, you know.
You're right.
He talks about the Wagner Act and National Labor Relations Act, how that was, rather than, you know, than protecting or emboldening unions, it actually brought them under greater control. And, of course, the term, he also points out the term racket or racketeering comes from racketeering in relations to unions, particularly organized crime, the mob. Of course, he also points out the mob is, they're functionaries of the oligarchs. That they're not independent. They're not the big guys, right. You know. And he also addresses New Deal policies, and also the how with the Wagner Act and sort of the how it brought on, you know, the prosperous post World War era, late 40s, 50s, and 60s, how conditions did improve for the wage earner, the typical American. He says, well, this was probably because they realized that maybe they had gone too far in the Great Depression. And the way to really, maintain your racket, to keep your system going, is to let everyone wet their beak a little bit, have them a piece of the action, and you sort of bribe people with this false prosperity. And that was all part of this post-war, you know, post-New Deal, post-war Fair Deal, Truman prosperity of the Bretton Woods system, which only lasted, what, a generation or two before it began to collapse in the 70s, so...
Right.
But, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that. So, the final, like in my little notes here, I just want to mention is that he does a good job of exposing Smedley Butler as a lifetime actor.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He goes into his background. And again, I just wanted to, just in a general sense, Tim, mention that this is a really good methodology. And it's one that, you know, Miles Mathis is really developed, and now Josh is following the same path. I know, you know, you and I in our shows, we get into it quite a bit. And so basically, you know, with Butler, when you see his position, right, of creating this limited hangout about war as a racket and distracting from looking at the secret society, and then his relationship into this fake, you know, this bogus banking thing, which is just the business plot against FDR that he's promoting, which is just clearly being done to, you know, to establish FDR as a man of the people, which is ludicrous. You're dealing with a lifetime actor, right? So Butler is, and what he points out is that he's a Quaker. So, you know, when Josh does analysis, he tries to go back through people's genealogies and sees, you know, who connects to what. This is the way that Butler represents himself as a Quaker is really important because, you know, his nickname was the Fighting Quaker, right? Okay, well, you see, Quakers are supposed to be pacifists.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, you have a contradiction, and this is a red flag that researchers should go, wait a second, you know, who is this guy? And it turns out when you look at Butler's family, it's a whole, you know, multiple generations of fighting Quakers, right? So like you wonder, well, why are they Quakers since they're always fighting wars and leading people over the top? Well, they're not, you see. This is a fake. This is just part of the way that people are fooled, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's these families burrow in as, you know, some kind of religion that they've converted to. But believe me, you know, their Masonic and ethnic backgrounds are not forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And that now when they come forward, you go, well, it's a Quaker. See, this is a certain thing in a mind of a person. It leads you into a confused place. Because then when you go forward through, you know, Butler's life, you start to see, well, everything is a lie. I mean, his Medal of Honor turns out to be just completely fictional, right? This goes back, think about the Swift Boats with John Kerry, right?
Yeah.
Now, Kerry was outed as someone with a Jewish background. He said, oh, I didn't even know, but okay. Well, but you were a Skull and Bones member. Well, that's odd. And now when you went to Vietnam, it looked like you just went there to get a Medal of Honor, except you got caught. And you couldn't get your Medal of Honor. You see, the guy was being set up for a career in politics and political power from the very beginning, right?
He poses the anti-war candidate, you know, perfect
exactly. For the mid-70s. Well, Bill Clinton, you know, with the beard, you know, and mm-hmm. so this is
and get people really hate them and to really love them.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right. That's how that, you know, it's Bush versus Hillary, mm-hmm. or excuse me, Trump versus Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this passionate dialectic that is always. People mistake for democracy when all they're really looking at is manipulation.
That's an interesting point, because in that article he also mentions Randolph Hearst's role here as an actor. How he's publishing articles like by Goering and Goebbels and sort of taking the German side. This is in the 30s. And siding with the isolationist, non-interventionist, American First Committee types. Of course, this also smears those who don't want to enter the war as being pro-Nazi. At the same time, it characterizes FDR as being on the other side. Again, that part of that dialectic that's being created.
Yeah, I just got an email and I was reading it, and basically it has a lot of stuff from the next article which I hadn't read, and there Josh mentions that. The 33 years that Butler, I thought he'd missed it because he hadn't.
Okay, yeah, I've read the second article yet. Yeah.
So I just want to correct myself that his research was you know, really good. He caught on to the idea that it was that the 33 is just you know, it's just like a little Masonic code.
Yeah,
you know.
And what year did Hitler and Franklin Delano Roosevelt attained power?
Wasn't that 33?
Yeah, it was March 4th, 1933. He was inaugurated as the 31st president of the, 32nd yeah. president of the United States, and of course Hitler ascended to power in January 1933. So,
yeah. These are just your little clues as to, you know. I tell you, when I got the Bolshevik note with the swastika. And that's you could go online and look at it. I was astounded when I saw this. But it turns out that it's actually something that is online. They actually have pictures of it so people can see it. And just notice that the 45 degree angles, right? Mm-hmm. As they point it, you know, they have the little end of the thing going down, so it fits right into the square and compass, and I think that, you know, helps people understand it's a 33 project, Tim.
Yeah, and of course with the Bolsheviks there was the folks at Kuhn Loeb, Jacob Schiff, who financed Trotsky
to Russia. Thanks a lot, guys.
And it was Max Warburg in Germany who facilitated Lenin's return on the
thanks a lot
train.
Really helping civilization out, aren't they? They're just altruists. They just want to have a workers' paradise. These are just people who care about the Europeans and just want the best for them. Can't you see it, Tim? Isn't it clear?
Mm-hmm. Now, this is interesting history. It certainly can't have nothing to do with what's going on today, can it?
Yeah, right. No, it's impossible. I mean, it's just so transparently part of the same process that, you know, I mean, people, as the new history is revealed, right, which is basically just the truth of the old history, the modern times will become more and more understandable. And all the fake dialectics and the lifetime actors and all the BS is going to just fall away, and these people will be naked. You see, they will be exposed, people like Hillary and Trump and Obama and Bill Clinton and, you know, George, the Bush family. I mean, you'll start to see who they really are. It's not a pretty sight, but it's one we have to experience, you know, so we know where we are in the world.
And all the chaos and trauma, it isn't history unfolding. It isn't blind forces. It isn't these things aren't just popping up, you know, everywhere, and our governments are responding to them. Each crisis as they come. Now, these are plans that are unfolding throughout the decades. And if you look at Vietnam and the Vietnam War and the effect it had and how it facilitated the rise of the counterculture, which was, you know, manufactured, and this, Chris, what does this do? It creates sort of this contempt for authority. It also, at the same time, a reaction of one part of the population would cling to authority. So there's your dialectic. It creates the conditions for the drug war, the youth culture, which you have, we've gone through how all that was being promoted the decade prior in life, in time by Time Life, with the drug promotion of drugs and these things, with the MK Ultra subproject, was it 58 with the Time Life article, yeah. And, how the war itself facilitated the importation of heroin, created heroin addicts, and all these wars that we see going on, whether it's in Afghanistan or Latin America or Indochina, you always have these drug routes, lucrative drug routes.
Well, and they have a narrative that can't stand any scrutiny, and that's why, see, and I think that, incidentally, I think, Tim, you're to be complimented, because I think you're having an enormous impact on presidential policy. Trump, realizing that he couldn't give any sophistry because he knew that it wouldn't pass your scrutiny, he abandoned it last week, and he said, you know, hell, we're not there for anything, and we're not in Afghanistan for anything at all. Mm-hmm. We don't have any idea about, you know, the nation or the culture, whatever. Who knows? We're just there to kill terrorists. That's all. We're just there to kill, you know. And who is a terrorist? But don't even bother to ask. They're all terrorists. I mean, and basically, so it's just now because of researchers like you and the new history that's starting to, you know, the public are getting used to. They're just going to have to start switching gears, man, because I just think it's, you know, it's sort of like the terrorist events, like the business in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. I just think that there's just too many skeptical people and too much information that's getting out, and they have to be careful when they do this stuff to not basically have exactly the opposite effect to what they want.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean? In other words, that they when they have something like Charlottesville, and now they're trying to add to it, you know, with all of this crazy conflict, you know, with Antifa and you know, they're I mean, it's just they're trying to stir the pot to create this idea of hatred between groups and then exploit that. But, you know, I don't know. I just think that it's going to be tougher as they go forward because there are just too many people that don't buy the BS anymore.
No, because it's too much out. I mean, how do you, you know, if you're familiar with COINTELPRO or Gladio or Soros's involvement in other countries, also in this country with its open society and the funding of Black Lives Matter, this is all there to just stir up trouble and have people start throwing, you know, bricks and broken bottles at each other.
Sure.
You know, that's what it's designed to do. And, you know, you have to be a little savvy about these things. How, if you look at any, if there's any neo-Nazi or Klan activity going on in this, everyone knows it's agent provocateur. You know, at least anyone who's informed, it's agent provocateur sent in there just, you know, it's like... You know,
I mean, these guys take off the sheets and the capes, and they go straight back to military intelligence bases, basically. You know, I mean, just the whole thing is just a complete cutout of from the oligarchs to try to confuse the population. And, you know, population should not respond when they have these crazy stuff. Do not respond. Get out the coffee table. I keep saying that, you know. Sit on the street corner and just say, you know, I'm here as a citizen under the First Amendment with my right to free speech, and I want to talk about the possibility that some secret society is manipulating all of us, and this whole damn thing that we're engaged with right here, this terrorist thing, is fake. It was created by people other than the ones that they're getting blamed.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I want to...
You heard about that judge down there who equated the people who are destroying Confederate monuments to ISIS.
He was
suspended for his remarks, although I think the analogy is apt.
Well,
it's funny because if you look at it, what he's saying is, I don't know if he realized what he's saying, is that ISIS is a creation of what is a they're cutouts. So
yeah, they're just a cutout.
If
so
that's true,
the
then
thing.
That's a very fair, that's a very apt analogy on many levels.
Finally, a judge that can think clearly. I mean, we should run him for governor.
Of course, they suspend him. On what basis, I don't know. It's just his opinion. You know, so now, I guess, it's a grounds for suspension if you don't advocate the taking down of Confederate statues. And so, you know.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, it's, so, you know, here we've, you know, this is just really good stuff. The business plot, which is an obvious fake, and because it's an obvious fake, it allows everybody to see, you know, because when the fake is exposed, the people who created it and their motivation becomes clear. Do you see what I mean? It's sort of like they've got the smoke, but whenever we just blow the smoke away, we get to see the reality. And so you get to see that Butler is a limited hangout, that he is a lifetime actor. You get to see that Roosevelt is manipulating the culture, basically, which is, you know, basically illegal, you know, to use this kind of propaganda against the people, that he's not a man of the people, and that the group is also identified, because you can see who benefits from this, you know, who is not going to be focused upon, you know. It's you know, it's the secret society. It's the, you know, that and their purpose, right? Which is not money. It's destruction of peoples.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but he still has his huge memorial down here down near Washington D.C., where they have it's broken up into four segments for each administration. So, because of course,
really.
Yeah, it's rather it's one of the largest memorials, the FDR memorial. It's like,
Well, FDR was just an absolute cesspool. I mean, it's just, you know, they give him this homage as like a liberal, but it's only because liberals are just not thinking clearly. I mean, Social Security is the biggest boondoggle imaginable. It just takes money out of working people's paychecks and distributes it to other people in smaller amounts than it's taken in. But in the meantime, the money sits there and is all used by the oligarchs for warfare.
Yes.
Right?
And then the trust funds.
You'll see in a few years the thing is going to go belly up, and they'll go, well, gee whiz, it's just, sorry to see it didn't work out.
Sorry.
We enjoyed using your money for all these years. So that's the thing, is FDR is given this, you know.
And it also destroys extended families because it destroys the natural bond that one generation has to the next, like caring for the old.
Once the money comes from the state, right, it's just like with what happened in the African-American families in the 60s. Once the paycheck comes from the state and the state is malevolent, which it is, you are on a path to destruction.
Yep.
And every single time. And so to fight back, we have to recreate the culture that we had, which is ethnic communities, ethnic pride, the Irish communities. I'm not even sure how we'll recreate them, but we need to head in that direction. We need to head back to communities.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had a discussion with E. Michael Jones just recently, and he was talking about the his book called How Meyer Lansky Took Over the Cincinnati Ballet and what four ballerinas did about it. They went and got pregnant and quit the ballet. That's about the cultural warfare targeting Cincinnati because there was a huge Catholic population, German Catholic population in Cincinnati, where it was targeted by the ADL and the FBI, working with the FBI, specifically in the 30s, but how it was with all types of cultural warfare. One is the Mapplethorpe, the obscenity trials, and also the, from Hustler magazine, Larry Flint, how that his obscenity trials, these are all setups to set Cincinnati up, to sort of overwhelm the locals there, the Catholics in Cincinnati. But he was talking about some of these, how Bobby Kennedy, as a Catholic attorney general of the United States, went after some of these Jewish pornographers. And the reason why he did it is because there was a local sheriff in Newport, Kentucky, who was trying to clean up Newport, Kentucky. Newport, Kentucky was the center of vice in the area. Cincinnati would never allow this stuff, and Cincinnati should be able to have to go across the river there into Kentucky to gamble and use prostitutes and stuff like that. If you remember, that's where Jerry Springer got in trouble. He was a councilman in Cincinnati. He got caught writing a check to a prostitute in a Kentucky bordello.
What a shock!
But anyway, there was a in the 1960s there was a guy running for sheriff of Newport, Kentucky, under the campaign to clean up Kentucky, to kick out the casino operators and bordello operators who were mostly Jewish, Mo Dalitz, Meyer Lansky, that crowd. What happened was got the attention. The guy, his name was George Roderman. He got the attention of Bobby Kennedy because Roderman was a football star at Notre Dame. That was back when Notre Dame was Catholic. Kennedy's being Catholic recognized the name, and they see that this is an example of sort of this Catholic ethnic identity, ethno-religious identity, kind of motivating them to kick out this malevolent influence, using the police powers to kick out this malevolent influence in Kentucky. How it wasn't so much politics that drove these two men together; it was this identity, this Catholic identity that made them work
together.
What happened was he was elected sheriff because what happened was he was running against the casino operators. They slipped him a Mickey and took pictures of him with a naked girl.
And
his wife knew he was a good husband. So she went out the next day and got his blood tested, and then he had all his drugs in his blood. So it broke that he was set up, and it made him win because even the Protestants backed this Catholic as sheriff after that. So he actually won the election of sheriff and then chased him out of Newport. That's when they all went to Las Vegas. It's an interesting story. But the point is, it gets back to this the importance of sort of this an ethno-religious identity, which was destroyed in the post-war era, by the destruction of the urban these ethnic urban neighborhoods and the creation of suburbia, the interstate highway system, and the, you know, promotion of the consumerist society. So, you know, but that's an example of how important it is. And also the story you tell about your friend, how they, some guy was...
in Lake Erie, that's a good Irish story. Community, the pornographer came to town. It was just dirty pictures, but... Yeah. That, you know, he tried to sell them to kids, teenagers, and the dads found out about it and just beat the hell out of them.
Yeah.
And that's how you respond to cultural pollution.
Yeah, you don't get that type of celebrity, solidarity in a typical suburban community because no one knows each other.
No, I mean, Michael Jones is really a great researcher, great researcher. I mean, people should follow him because he really comes up with a lot of data that no one has understood, and he's really important. And I love his metaphor that the U.S. has become a gay disco.
Yes.
And, you know,
dance your troubles away at the gay disco, yeah.
And I'm not hating on gay people. See, I get a lot of emails about this, and I'm hating on gay people. Look, the homosexuality was weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's sort of like feminism, right? It's you have to understand cultural influences as having the power of being weaponized. You see, when you understand that, then you can see that these forces were developed, organized in a certain way, with a certain perspective, as weapons. You see, and so they were being created not with the idea of let's have fun as homosexuals, right? It was, let's shatter a culture with the ultimate objective of genocide.
Mm-hmm. The same thing with the civil rights movement, black civil rights movement.
Exactly. You see, so weaponized. That's the thing. Integration. Mm-hmm. So you have weaponized integration, weaponized feminism, weaponized homosexuality. When you talk about these things as weapons and you make a comment that the U.S. has become a gay disco, people say, well, there it is. You know, there's a, you know, a homophobe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or even that word.
Yeah. But the fact is, we're trying to basically expose the real history. It's just like when you point out that the Warburg brothers created the Treaty of Versailles and are bringing about Hitler deliberately, right? Mm-hmm. That this is that is an area of research, hard to prove, but sure looks suspicious and needs more sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
When you make a statement like that. Well, people go, well, you know, this could be coming from a bad place in your heart. Maybe you're anti-Semitic. Well, what about just trying to understand history, right? What about trying to get to the real history? You have to worry about all of these things that have been weaponized, and even anti-Semitism as a force can be weaponized.
Oh, right? Yes, because that itself is a rabbinical trick because, well, it's a dialectic there. It's a Talmudic strategy where is you encourage all types of, you know, abrasive or negative behavior to get the reaction to, so the general community reacts to this behavior, and that in itself then reinforces the group cohesion of the oppressed minority, the Jews.
Exactly. See, there's all kinds of little tricks like that that can be used, and that the public needs to be exposed to them, so we can defend ourselves. Because if you look at the last 120 years, we haven't done a very good job of it, have we?
Well, look at the culture. You're going to tell me all this is accidental? Oh, well, look around you. You're swimming in a toxic culture everywhere you go, entertainment, music, education. And if you look at what's fed to us, you're going to tell me that the past 30, 40 years, look at the state of culture and that this is just happening because it's a natural course of things? There's just decadence is a certain momentum that... You know, that can't be directed. No, it just there's too much. The documents have been exposed. The connections are there. MK Ultra, the authoritarian personality, the Rockefeller backing of Kinsey, their backing of the Russell Sage Foundation.
I mean, the end of World War II with C.D. Jackson, Ewan Cameron, and Bernays in control of the narrative. I mean, they're all propaganda people. They're not historians. I mean, for God's sakes, they got Billy Wilder down filming in the concentration camp.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just to any sober person as a collection is just impossible to be accidental. There is something going on that we don't understand.
And why that is
everyone involved is a propagandist.
Because they... Well, because when you have all the money, you can buy the historians, you can endow the universities, you can set up things like the General Education Board that sets the pattern for public education for the next century. And how we understand the world is by through these educational institutions, through the media institutions, through the newspapers, which they all bought out or controlled. We know that. I mean, that was mentioned by Oscar Calloway, the senator, in 1917. Just the purchase of a couple dozen newspapers.
Bonbon on this. So the original cultural Marxist, Gregor Oluchas, that's not his real name. His real name is like Lowenstein or something. He changed it to sound Hungarian.
Yeah.
He was hired by Bela Kun, who was the head of the Hungarian Soviet in 1917. Oh, that was not his real name either. It was Bela Kun, but he changed his name. So they put old Gregor in charge of the education of Hungarian young people, right?
Yeah.
And so you get the deranged sexual, like, you know, marriage is property, free love, just have sex. You know, I mean, obviously just a full throttle attack on family. But there was something else that he did. And I was unaware. I had to do quite a bit of research to get to that. I'd wondered about this, you know, this Magic Kingdom meme, you know, that Walt Disney then brings out. Well, as it turns out, old Gregor, he wasn't just kind of with the, you know, the Freudian Marxist sexual degeneracy, you know, kind of position. But he would take the children, and I mean hundreds of thousands of them, and then they would have what are called fairy tale afternoons, where they would be read fairy tales, right, for hour and hour. And Lucas said, you know, he said, this is really terrific because the kids lose their identity. They even think of themselves as becoming the characters or animals in the story. and this is just wonderful because we have a real communism. You see, even their identity as humans is gone away. And all that's left is kind of a consciousness that just is susceptible to everything. This actually is what he wrote.
I mean, that sounds like Disney.
Well, you better believe it's Disneyland. With remember Mouseketeers?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Right. So you see, folks, what you see is not really history unfolding, but there are people sitting there going, how do we get this accomplished? And so when you go from Gregor Luchas, I wish I could pronounce his real name. I don't have it. But, you know, he changed his name. It was a Jewish name. You know, when he's talking about disintegrating the personalities of these European kids using fairy tales so that they imagine themselves as animals, and you plug that into cultural Marxism, right, which then helps, you know, the forces that end up with the Disney World and all of the fantasies, right, that are now, you know, in play. I think it's pretty, you know, okay, it's not a perfectly straight line, but it sure is enough, you know, there's enough clarity that this should become like an area of urgent research so that when people now start looking at Disneyland and the sort of influence, you know, that, you know, is this another, you know, like fictional story with a little bit of psychology in back of it? Hey, like Smedley Butler, you know, and so this is the thing is that with the new history, you know, and I was kind of, okay, Tim, I had a thought. I wanted to share this with you. So when Luchas was, you know, working with Bela Kun or Kohn, and they created all of the, you know, the way to like, destroy the kind of the philosophical principles of Western civilization. They came with something called critical theory.
Yeah.
You probably heard of it, right? Critical theory, which basically means you just find a way to criticize everything.
Mm-hmm.
You try to reduce everything to negativity. It's sort of like the process that Luchas was doing with the minds of kids, right? Where you end up where even your own sense of being a human is gone.
This is the deconstructionism, right?
Yeah. Deconstruction, right. Mm-hmm. So everything is deconstructed. Well, you know, you see, Tim, what Tim Kelly and Joe Atwell are doing is we're doing our own little critical theory.
That's not fair. That's anti-Semitic.
And we are going to criticize everything about our existing culture.
Yeah.
You see, turnabout is fair play, my friend. You see? So now they were able to use critical theory against us. Well, you know what? We're just going to do the same thing back to them and start to deconstruct every one of these little psychological operations and tools that they've constructed to be able to control us. And let's just see what we can come up with over time.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Exactly. Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, Mickey Mouse. I heard someone just say, yeah, it's funny how Mickey Mouse is Disney because mouse is what you experiment on. If you identify as a rodent, you will they can experiment on you. So
yeah, we want to learn about Mickey Mouse. Just it's online. Go look at the cartoon Bimbo's Initiation.
Yeah.
And you'll see Mickey locking poor Bimbo in a Freemason lodge.
It's
1927 or something, you know.
It's just
you'll understand that the Mouseketeer is part of the world of Gregor Lukacs, is part of the world of cultural Marxism, is part of the world of organized high-level Freemasonry. It's not something for kids, you know, the Mouseketeer.
No.
No, I mean, I know, once again, people will say, oh, this is crazy. It's like, you know, how can you be opposed to integration or Mouseketeers? You're so eccentric. I'm not opposed to these things. I'm just saying, hey, don't forget to study them as potential weapons,
yes,
cultural weapons.
Amusement parks. And remember,
yeah,
they're designed to make you not think.
Amuse. Yeah.
And of course, if you just get into Disney, that's kind of like, you know, whether it's Epcot, which was the Experimental Planned Community of Tomorrow or something.
Yeah.
It's all scientism, and it's all sort of this scientific dictatorship type dynamic, because they have all this smart stuff, you know, where apparently they have a plan now where you have a chip, and the goofy characters will be able to identify your kid by name, which is creepy.
Yeah, you don't want to take children into that place.
They go there by the millions, and it's like entertainment in general. It's like
and once the new history is out, let's hope that the camps, the Disney compounds are vacant.
Yeah, do you remember Disney a while back was going to have a historical theme park in Virginia? The plan didn't go through because of zoning or something, but they were going to have to open up a theme park dedicated to history, right? The Disneyfication of history, you know. And that, boy, that's great. That's like
God Almighty.
You know, that's well, we get that anyway in the universities. So
well, we do. I mean, right. I mean, the only problem was it would put the Ivy League out of business, because it would be the same, you know, nonsense history that's being taught, except it would probably be more fun than the Ivy League.
So, okay, well, Joe, I guess we covered it.
Thank you so much, great. Tim. I mean, next week we're going to be even more fun and more thrilling.
Yeah, I think your idea the vaccines idea is a good idea. We'll go there.
Well, we'll do something, but I mean, but it's going to be thrilling and fun, because this was actually, we could do another show on this. I love this subject. I think it's really interesting. There's a lot of research that Josh did, and a lot of original contributions we can make, because this is how it goes, you know, when someone gets into a vein of gold like this, it helps everyone else see other things, new connections get made, and it just, we can start the process of getting the real history, you know, decoded so we can see it.
Now that's The Bogus Business Plot, Part 1, What Isn't a Racket, by Josh G. And you said the second part is now posted?
I was sent it as a link to it as an email, yeah.
Okay, so I'll take a look at that. So
it's part two, right? Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, listen, Joe, enjoy the weekend.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's been a great pleasure. I'll talk to you next week.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
All right, brother. Bye-bye.